friends, welcome to the Her God Speaks podcast. I am your host, April Swears. I'm here with my dear friends, Diana Dunn and Hope Henshi.
Hello.
Hey. You guys almost forgot to say that. We are 9 episodes in. Woo! Right? Episode 9. Okay. And just to remind our listeners, we're doing all of these in one day. It's like a marathon recording and we're having so much fun. It's like such a treat to get to hang out with each other. And of course with you who are listening, just a couple reminders. One, that workbook, I know we're toward the end of the series, but it is still available if you want to pick one up or if you want to pick a few up for some friends. So you guys can go back through this series together. Mm-hmm. You can access those, in the hergodspeaks.com shop. Also, please continue to share about the podcast. You guys are awesome at that. I so appreciate it. But that is certainly the best way for the podcast to grow and for more people to hear about it and more people to be able to enjoy some good. Well, I hope it's good Bible teaching. I have a hard time saying anything that would be like positive about myself. But, you know, working through that elsewhere. We don't need to have a therapy session right here.
Right.
Okay. All right. So all three of us at this table are Andrew Peterson fans. Those of you listening, yep, you don't know who Andrew Peterson is. You need to enter that name into Google. And my goodness, he is a songwriter, singer, songwriter, author of both amazing fiction and nonfiction. Yes. His book, God of the Garden, is one of my favorite books that I read last year. So yeah, some pretty big fans around this table. Yes. But Hope is what you might call a super fan. Is that fair?
Completely.
Okay.
I think I've already mentioned him like so many times on this podcast.
I think so. So Hope has an Andrew Peterson story that I have been waiting all of these episodes for her to share with you guys. It's one of my favorite stories. And so I'm trying not to hype it too much, but it's pretty cool. So go ahead.
So in 2019, Andrew Peterson and some of my favorite writers and artists in a group called The Rabbit Room went like on tour to some homeschool conventions to give some talks. And they had a panel discussion and I went to the one in Jacksonville. And when I saw all these people on the stage who had written stories that stoked my imagination about the kingdom and gave me a childlike longing for home, I decided to ask the panel, which included Andrew Peterson, when they daydream about heaven, what do they think about?
Okay, so I'm trying to get the setting. So there's like a stage.
Yes.
And these brilliant creatives.
Yes, sitting in
chairs.
Of course,
Andrew Peterson hates using the words creatives.
Yes, because we're all creative.
We're all creative. Okay, yeah. So, all right, so we're not going to use that word. We're going to honor Andrew Peterson.
Yes.
Okay, so they're all there. Is there like open mic kind of thing, or do you?
Yeah, you can walk up to the mic. Walk up to the mic. Ask a question.
So you actually verbalize this question.
Yes. So there was like Jonathan Rogers, Jennifer Trafton, Douglas K. McKelvey, who wrote Every Moment Holy. Oh, you know, yes. some of my heroes.
Okay.
And so I asked them when they daydream about heaven, what do they think about? Because all of them just they made me feel like a kid when I read their stuff, and so I feel like they're like children, you know, like they have a childlikeness. So I want to hear their daydreams. And I don't remember I really remember what any of them said, but each person's answer was so beautiful. They were all crying and I was crying and I'm sure a lot of the other people in the audience were crying. We just all felt homesick together thinking about it. And afterwards, I was in the exhibit hall and someone tapped me on the shoulder and it was Andrew Peterson. And he told me he really appreciated my question and it was the best panel question ever heard. So
has your heart ever beat faster in your whole life?
I'm sure that
aside from the squirrel moccasin shoes.
I'm sure I immediately turned into a tomato. And also, I guess I should say, the first Andrew Peterson concert that I went to, my husband and I were planning to go up and meet him and have him sign like our books for our kids. But when the moment came after the concert, I was so nervous that I made my husband go by himself and I hid outside the building. And I was just so afraid. And Andrew had broken his leg and he was in a cast. And Peter said, so my wife's your biggest fan, but she's too scared to meet you. Can you come to her? She's like hiding outside the building. Yeah. And Andrew was like, I mean, I can't. His leg was broken. Oh my God. So thankfully he didn't do that. But anyway, so I was like, he can never know that Peter and I are that, like, that I am that wife. Like,
right. Right. Oh my
word. So anyway, did I already say that later he posted on Instagram?
No, you haven't. So he tapped you on the shoulder. Thanked you for the yes. great question.
Okay. And then later he posted on Instagram and Twitter about the greatest panel question he's ever been asked. Wow. And I mean, he didn't mention me by name or anything. But so it's just kind of funny because I was too nervous to meet him. But then he met me.
Yeah.
Wow. That's my celebrity.
You're worth
story.
Meeting Hope.
You are. You really are. I feel like you would totally fit in with the Hutch Moot.
Oh, for sure.
I would love to.
For sure.
I've been to the Northwind Manor, like their physical location, because the Wingfeather Saga that Andrew Peterson wrote, it's a show now. Okay. And you can go and watch there's like a launch party and you can watch it. And so it's so cool. They have like Tolkien's fireplace. Wow. So you could sit like where he like and look at what he looked at when he finished writing Lord of the Rings.
Wow.
And like, so yeah, they're my people and I would love to get deeper into that community. But if he ever hears this, he'd be like, weirdo.
No, I bet he still remembers that moment and that question. And I love it. And I just think I think it's the coolest story. It's also the best lead in to the lesson today. For us to share how we'd answer that question. So you asked them how they would answer that question. And I would love to know. I'd like us all to share, like, what about new creation, new heaven, new earth, life after death, are you most looking forward to?
I think the concept that really intrigues me is just thinking of, like, all of life as worship.
Yeah.
Because growing up, so much, many of us had this idea that spiritual life and like our physical, like, quote, non-spiritual life were very separate. And we had this image in our minds of this eternal worship service. But reframing that and thinking of, like, all of my life is going to be unhindered by sin and worshipful. That's so beautiful. It's something it's hard to wrap our minds around, right? It requires imagination because it's hard to imagine living in a place it's hard to even imagine myself as not fallen. Like, right. I feel like I battle inwardly in my mind so much. It's hard to even imagine having an experience other than that. But just to get to do life and for every moment of that to be worship is, like, so exciting to me. I think if I could add on one more thing too, just about a mental picture that I have, I guess, just when of the new creation, the first thing I usually imagine is just literally, like, falling at Jesus's feet. And I know that sounds so cliche, but I imagine, like, you know, when you're running, like, a runner is running a race and they get to the end and they just collapse because it's like, I'm spent, exhausted. Like, that's the image that comes to my mind most often. Right. Because I do wrestle with, like, spiritual doubts. And a lot of times I'm just, like, mentally, like, so tired because I wrestle so much inwardly in my mind. So it's just, I imagine myself just falling at his feet and my faith that is so hard won and so mingled with unbelief is going to be sight. Like, it's going to be like a reality that I can feel and taste and touch and smell and see. That is so exciting.
Yeah. It's really beautiful.
That thought fuels me a lot.
Yeah. And there are so many people, and we were talking about this last night, the three of us, just that such a doubt can be such a burden, and some people just have it. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of there nagging in the background all the time, those it's questions.
Like my thorn in the flesh, I feel like.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we could sit here and analyze why or whatever, and I think some brains are just kind of wired that way, and some people are more just very thoughtful about the brain's just always going.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do. I love the whole faith being made sight. Yeah. Such a beautiful reality.
That is so good, Diana.
Yeah. So good.
One thing that's like hard for me is meeting people that I would love to know more. Yeah. Like there are people I've met like at a conference or at a wedding or even you guys, like where it's like, we're not neighbors. Like, mm-hmm. and I wish that we could just be best friends and live right next to each other and do life together. And I'm excited to meet people all over the world and from all of human history. And I get to be friends with them and I get to hear their stories. And that kind of helps me think about like, I will have stuff to do for eternity because humans are so amazing and I will get to know all these humans and like, I want to eat cheese and go on adventures with them. One time I went to the zoo and I whispered to the cheetahs, I'm going to ride on your back someday with my favorite theologians. So there's a little picture for you.
Yeah, oh my just gosh. Riding on a cheetah back with C.S. Lewis. Cheetahs. Hey, you guys, when we get to the new creation, let's plan a cheetah ride.
All right, let's do it.
It's on the calendar.
Right. It's on the calendar.
Don't forget the cheese.
Cheese and cheetahs. Like Diana was saying, like, it's so hard to imagine relationships without sin.
It is.
Like, it really is.
So I'm really excited about having a perfect relationship with my husband and with my kids and family members, where we're just brothers and sisters.
Yeah. Mm. We're all such a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And it does complicate relationships very much. I love that. I think the thing and it kind of changes different seasons of life, what I'm looking forward to most. Right now, I'm very like more of a melancholy person, very prone to sadness. Mm-hmm. Some days I just wake up and I'm just sad. Mm-hmm. And it's not rare, you know. And I can't always pinpoint why. I have a pretty charmed life. There's no like a lot of like profound hardship or I just very, very prone to just sadness and blahness. And I think it was N.T. Wright one time told a story about, I don't know if it's a colleague or a friend or a family member, that when he describes heaven to his children, calls it the no tears place.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that is
so good. Yeah. And because a child would associate tears with sadness for sure. Although we can cry happy tears, but I just, that reality of like the no tears place, like I'm never going to wake up and have to fight being sad.
Wow.
Tearing up now.
You're going to cry sad tears for the last time.
So just that, the wholeness that we'll experience. Because sometimes, like, we're just complex creatures, right? And I'm learning more about brain science because I have a, you know, child with disability and trying to just learn about the connection between the brain and the body. And it's so complex. And so many things can get out of whack, and that can make life so hard. And that'll all be healed and whole, and like our brains and our bodies and how we commune with Jesus and each other. And like, it's just this holistic healing, this true shalom, will just permeate everything. And we'll cry sad tears for the last time. And, man, that's going to be really good. And then we're going to go ride cheetahs. And there'll be no division between secular and sacred. It'll just all be worship.
Yeah.
Cheetah riding will be worship, you guys.
Yes.
Pretty awesome.
So really, like, heaven is all a worship service.
Yeah.
It's just we expand our view of what worship is.
Yes.
You know?
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
Yes.
Way to take it for a full circle. I love it. Oh, I love it so much. All right. So we are going to dive into Revelation 21 and 22.
Woo-hoo.
You guys, we've made it to the end of the Bible. This is big. This is really big. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Let's go. This episode of the Heaven series is a big deal because we're finally at the very end of our Bibles. The finish line is visible. The crowds are cheering. We are almost there, friends. We are almost there. We have spent, let's see, 8 episodes getting ourselves ready to do what we are going to be doing in this episode, and that is walking through Revelation 21 and 22, which requires an understanding of Genesis 1 through 3, the themes of temple and kingdom, the Old Testament prophetic hope, and the resurrection. So finally, after exploring all of that, we have arrived at the ultimate heaven passage. Now, a couple things before we get started. First, I want to remind you where Revelation 21 is on our timeline. So if you have that workbook, go ahead and turn to page 10. All right, so take a look at the diagram that is labeled Biblical View. It's the second one. Obviously, we're not talking about the present age today. We are talking about the part of the diagram that's on the far right, the age to come. Could also be referred to as the future heaven, the eternal state, the new creation, or my favorite, N.T. Wright calls it life after death. Now, I mentioned this in our very first week together, but I think it's worth mentioning again. When you and I talk about heaven, we are usually talking about life immediately after death. We go to a funeral or a celebration of life service, whatever you want to call it, and we talk about how that loved one is in heaven. When we use heaven in that way, we are not talking about the future heaven, the eternal state. We are talking about the present heaven. Scholars refer to it as the intermediate state. And what I talked about in the first week is that the biblical authors were like the complete opposite of us. So when we talk about heaven, we talk almost entirely about the intermediate state, life immediately after death. When the biblical authors talked about heaven, they were concerned almost entirely with the new heaven and the new earth, the future heaven, the ultimate heaven, the consummation of God's kingdom, the eternal state, which will go on forever and ever and ever and ever. The only thing the biblical authors tell us about the intermediate state is that believers are with Jesus. That's it. That's it. So just wanted to circle back to that. I think it's really important to note. What we are talking about today, nobody is currently experiencing. This is something that believers will experience after the final resurrection. All right, so I want to make sure we are clear on that. Second thing I want to talk about before we dig into the passage is the genre of the book of Revelation, which is Jewish apocalyptic literature. Now, this type of literature, while super strange to us, was actually quite common in the Second Temple post-exilic period, which would be like around 500 BC to 70 AD. So in addition to Daniel and the book of Revelation, prominent literary apocalypses included the book of Enoch, Baruch, I don't know how to say that, B-A-R-U-C-K, 1st and 2nd Esdras, the apocalypse of Abraham, the apocalypse of Peter. I'm sure there are others. Now, all of these apocalypses communicate through heavy, intense use of imagery and word pictures, which poses a huge challenge for us modern readers. Would not have been such a challenge for the ancient readers, but for us, they're a total mind bender. And to help us better understand that challenge, I want you to think about something in our day that relies on a heavy use of imagery, and that's political cartoons. Now, I didn't want to break any copyright laws, so I did not include the cartoons I'm about to reference in the listening guide of the workbook, which, by the way, is on page 178. But if you want a visual of what I'm about to talk about, there is a link in the show notes to the cartoons I'm about to reference. For those who may be driving in a car or taking a walk or washing dishes or whatever, let me briefly describe the cartoons to you. All right, so in the first one, there is a rather distressed-looking donkey dressed up in a suit and tie, sitting at a table with a cup of coffee, holding a large can that says Cup of Joe. It's obviously a coffee can. On the coffee can is a picture of Joe Biden holding a cup of coffee, a pair of sunglasses, and a cheesy smile. At the very top of the can, it says Old Establishment Roast. And the roast is described as ultra mellow with many hints of vanilla. The expiration date of the coffee is emphasized. It's November 5th, 2024. In the second cartoon, a very plump Donald Trump, a plump Donald Trump, that rhymes so funny. Anyway, a plump Donald Trump is sitting on top of a donkey wearing a saddle that says 2016 election. But Trump isn't sitting directly on the donkey's back. There's some other stuff piled on top of the donkey, and then Trump is sitting on top of the pile. So he's actually sitting on top of bags labeled hush money and a file box labeled Russian meddling. Now, from his high horse or high donkey, he's pointing and shouting at a cartoon depiction of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. There's a word bubble coming from Trump that says, "You have legitimacy issues." Now, please know I am making no political statements with these. I chose them simply because I thought they'd be fairly easy to describe on an audio-only podcast. Now, if you are an American citizen who stays up on the main news headlines, you probably don't need too much explanation of what these cartoons are intended to communicate. But imagine that someone time traveled from an ancient culture and these cartoons were placed in front of them. They would make absolutely no sense at all. Here's what our ancient time traveling friend might think. Why in the world is that donkey wearing a suit? Donkeys don't wear suits, and they don't sit at tables, and they don't drink coffee. Who is the guy on the thing the donkey is holding? What is Joe? I think it's safe to say that nothing on the coffee can would make sense. Coffee itself may not make any sense. That phrase, best if used by, we know that's representing an expiration date, but our ancient time-traveling friend would have no idea about that. The second cartoon requires not just an understanding of American politics, but a basic understanding of Venezuelan politics as well. You'd also have to have some awareness of the scandals that are associated with the 2016 election. These silly-looking cartoons that make total sense to us without having to give them much thought at all are actually really complex. When you look at them, your brain is bringing together a whole bunch of concepts, ideas, and categories to form a particular message that, at least in the mind of the artist, corresponds to reality or some version of reality. It's actually quite astonishing when you consider what your brain has to do, the connections it has to make, the information it has to retrieve in order for you to understand what that political cartoon is communicating. Well, the same thing is happening with Jewish apocalyptic literature, except we are the time travelers. We are going back to a culture and a time about which we have very limited knowledge on our own. In his writing of Revelation, John assumes that his readers have been deeply immersed in the Hebrew scriptures and in the world of first century Roman Israeli politics. Now go ahead and raise your hand if you have done an in-depth study of Ezekiel and can articulate all of the visions and their implications. John assumes we have. Raise your hand if you can quote lengthy passages from the book of Isaiah and have a robust understanding of what those passages mean. John assumes we can. Raise your hand if you are familiar with Second Temple Jewish apocalyptic literature that isn't included in the canon of scripture. John assumes we are. While there aren't a whole lot of direct quotations of the Old Testament in the book of Revelation, nearly every single verse alludes to the Hebrew scriptures, and so much of the conflicts portrayed are deeply integrated with the political landscape of ancient Rome, which is a landscape most of us probably have very little knowledge of. Now, this little political cartoon illustration should help us understand why there's so much garbage written about the book of Revelation. Studying this book of the Bible demands a lot of time, a lot of mental energy, and a heck of a lot of humility. Modern readers generally don't excel in any of those areas. Quick book recommendation, Scott McKnight's new book, Revelation for the Rest of Us. I think that's what it's called. Anyway, just put in the search box, Scott McKnight Revelation. It'll come up. It looks phenomenal. I haven't read it, but he's been sharing excerpts on his Substack, and it's some of the best accessible stuff on the book of Revelation I've seen. I'm in a quote from G.K. Beale a lot in this episode. I love his commentary on the book of Revelation. He actually has two. One of them is called The Shorter Commentary on the Book of Revelation, and it's still like, I don't know, 600 pages. So it's great, but it's not really written for just regular people. McKnight's book is, and highly recommend. All right, well, with all this in mind, let's cautiously work through what I believe is one of the most gorgeous, hope-fueling passages in the entire Bible. Now, we're going to divide this message into four parts: the vision, the direction, the result, and the fulfillment. So the vision, the direction, the result, and the fulfillment. All right, that's where we're headed. Let's get started. Take a look at the vision. Chapter 21, I'm going to start reading in verse 1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. I also saw a holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared like a bride adorned for her husband. I'm going to skip down to verse 9. Then one of the seven angels who held the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came and spoke with me. Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. He then carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, arrayed with God's glory. Her radiance was like a precious jewel. What we see here is that there's three different word pictures or metaphors for the eternal state that get filled out in this passage. The first one is the image of a new heaven and a new earth. That is, of course, picking up the language of Genesis 1 and also the language of Isaiah 65, 17, where Isaiah specifically uses the phrase new heaven and new earth. Well, the second image that we see in this vision is that of a new Jerusalem, which is called the Holy City. And this image calls to mind the Davidic dynasty and Solomon's temple located in Jerusalem. And if you were to look in Isaiah 65, verses 17 through 19, what you would see is that the image of restoration of Jerusalem is connected to the ultimate restoration of all things in the age to come. So that's a concept that John did not come up with on his own. It's something that we see in the Old Testament. There's one more word picture in John's vision of the eternal state, and it's the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And this one is interesting because the bride is the city, and the city is the bride. Now, this is kind of strange until you realize that it also comes straight out of the book of Isaiah. Take a look at Isaiah 62, 1 through 5. I will not keep silent because of Zion, and I will not keep still because of Jerusalem, until her righteousness shines like a bright light and her salvation like a flaming torch. Nations will see your righteousness and all kings your glory. You will be given a new name that the Lord's mouth will announce. You will be a glorious crown in the Lord's hand and a royal diadem in the palm of your God's hand. You will no longer be called deserted, and your land will not be called desolate. Instead, you will be called, my delight is in her, and your land married. For the Lord delights in you, and your land will be married. For as a young man marries a young woman, so your sons will marry you. And as a groom rejoices over his bride, so your God will rejoice over you. Again, John did not come up with this idea of Zion, Jerusalem, being the bride. He is taking ideas that are already present in the Old Testament, building on them and connecting them with the future state. And when we see metaphors like this kind of all lumped together in scripture, the temptation is to try to figure out how they all fit together. And that would be thinking like a modern person. Ancient writers mixed metaphors without batting an eye or feeling any need to explain how those metaphors relate to one another. We need to see these as three different ways of looking at the age to come. My advice is don't waste any energy trying to map them onto each other or somehow melt them together into one mega image of the eternal state. Let each of these metaphors that John gives us for the new heaven and the new earth, for the new Jerusalem, for the bride, let them stand on their own and communicate different things, different facets of the eternal state. Also, remember, this is not a literal rendering of heaven. You know, we ask questions like, well, where exactly in the new heaven and the new earth is the new Jerusalem located? Like, we're thinking of a map, right? We want a literal rendering of the landscape of heaven, but John's not doing that. He's not drawing up a map. He's giving us word pictures, metaphors, instead of creating detailed timelines. A much more appropriate response to what John has given us here would be to write poems or songs or stories. This type of literature is supposed to stimulate our creative imaginations. When we try to turn it into a purely academic exercise, when we try to literalize everything in this and try to map it out and make it all fit and make it all work, I'm not saying that's a waste of time, but we need to be careful with that. We need to understand the kind of literature that we're dealing with here, because if we don't understand that, we risk totally missing the point that the author's trying to make. And we don't want to do that. That's not cool. All right, so that's the vision. We've got these three metaphors. Let's take a look at the direction of the passage. Now, in our first episode of this series, we talked about how, according to the traditional view of heaven, we believers escape this world and go up to heaven. A lot of our songs, all the way from like the really old hymns to modern worship songs being written today, depict that like upward movement of us from this earth to our, you know, sky mansion way up yonder in the sweet by and by. But take a look at how John describes the direction of things. I'm back in Revelation chapter 21, verse 1 again. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. I also saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared like a bride adorned for her husband. Now skip down to verse 9 again. Let's see. We have the one of the seven angels who says, come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. He then carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem. Look what it's doing. Coming down out of heaven from God. And of course, this is completely consistent with everything else we've examined in this series. The biblical view is not that we escape this world and go up, but that God remakes this world and comes down. Once you orient yourself to the proper direction of God's interaction with his creation, the meta narrative or big picture of scripture really starts to come alive. I love the Michael Bird quote on the very first page of the workbook. It says this: though God made heaven and earth, he intended to remake both and join them together forever. I would go so far as to say that the chief promise of the gospel is not that we go to heaven when we die, but that heaven will come to earth, transforming the world, renewing the earth, and remaking the cosmos. If there is one thing you take away from this study, I want it to be this: the entire Bible, from Genesis to Revelation, is the story of heaven coming here. All right, so we've covered the vision, we've covered the direction. We're going to spend the bulk of our time today on the result of heaven coming here, specifically focusing on what is going to be missing in the new creation and what will be present in the new creation. So we're going to start with what's missing, we'll talk about what's present, and then we'll move on to our final point of fulfillment. All right, what is going to be missing in the new heaven, in the new earth? Well, the first thing that's going to be missing is the first heaven and the first earth. We are told that it will pass away. Now, a couple of things to keep in mind as we're trying to figure out what exactly that means. First, our prototype for the old passing away leading to a new creation is Jesus himself, because that's exactly what happened to him. He really truly died, and his body was really truly transformed. So we could say with complete accuracy that the old body of Jesus passed away and the new glorified body of Jesus rose on the third day. But there's a qualifier, right? That doesn't mean there was total destruction of the old body. It doesn't mean that there was no continuity between the old body and the new body of Jesus. In fact, the eyewitness accounts reveal that there was quite a bit of continuity between the two. We should see the relationship between the old creation and the new creation through that lens. And John's word choice confirms this. There are two common words for new in the Greek: neos, I think I'm pronouncing that right. Anybody who's a Greek nerd, I apologize. I am not super up on Greek. But the transliteration is spelled N-E-O-S. And that word means new in time or origin, young, hasn't existed for very long. The other word for new in the Greek is kainos, which is transliterated K-A-I-N-O-S. And that word refers to something that is new in nature, different from the usual, superior in value or attraction. Now, what word do you think John uses? The second one, kainos. The new world is not new in that God creates it ex nihilo, out of nothing. It's not new in that it just came into existence. The world John describes here is new in the sense that it has been transformed into something far superior. It's that acorn to oak tree relationship we looked at in the resurrection episode. In other words, what happened on Easter morning to Jesus will happen to the whole world. So if you have this idea that when it says that the old heaven and the old earth will pass away, like if what comes to your mind is like the earth just being incinerated by God, you know, like all the Christians are raptured up to heaven and, you know, we get to be up there and basically scream, burn, baby, burn, at all the horrible pagans that are left behind here on this earth. Like, that is not, you know, that's just not the picture we're given. Like, this universe, this cosmos, this is where we're going to be. It's going to be utterly transformed. It's going to be completely resurrected. So in that sense, what we know of it now is going to pass away. But that doesn't mean it's going to be utterly destroyed for all time. It's going to experience its own resurrection. All right. So another thing that will be missing in the new heaven and the new earth, according to verse one, is the sea. Now, I wonder how many of you listening to this are ocean lovers. I sure am, especially West Coast oceans, the Pacific coast. I'm a little bit obsessed. So this verse is kind of heartbreaking, I have to say. Thankfully, as I have done my research, I have not come across a single reputable scholar who suggests that we ought to take this reference to there being no sea literally. Now, if you look at Genesis 1, 1 and 2, actually, I'll go ahead and turn there instead of trying to paraphrase it for you, which I would probably do a poor job at that. Genesis 1, 1 says this, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness covered the surface of the watery depths. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the waters." All right, so this is describing the pre-creation state of things. And it's depicted as vast chaos waters, right? So there's disorder, there's darkness. The image there is of these deep, deep waters of the deepest seas, which represented chaos, disorder, instability. That's the way things were prior to the creation events that are described in the rest of the chapter. And the biblical authors pick up on this. Isaiah 57:20 says, "The wicked are like the storm-tossed sea, for it cannot be still, and its waters churn up mire and muck." Psalm 46:2-3 says, "Therefore we will not be afraid, though the earth trembles and the mountains topple into the depths of the seas, though its waters roars and foams." Psalm 74:13-14 says, "You divided the sea with your strength. You smashed the heads of the sea monsters in the water. You crushed the heads of Leviathan." Again and again throughout the Bible, the sea stands for that which is chaotic and deadly. It's a symbol of decreation. If you take a look at ancient Israelite history, you'll notice they were never a seafaring people. They let the other nations take to the high seas. They stuck to the land. So we are missing the point if we're wondering if there will be any beaches in heaven. When John says, "And the sea was no more," he's saying that which is most threatening and dangerous and chaotic in this world will have no place in the new earth. Now, for us, it's not the sea. It's things like nuclear weapons, cybersecurity threats, global pandemics, natural disasters. Every people and every generation have their things that represent large-scale disorder and death. Whatever those things are, they won't be in the new creation. Now, our favorite list of things that won't be in the final heaven appears in verse 4 of Revelation 21. "He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Grief, crying, and pain will be no more because the previous things have passed away." In my opinion, aside from the Bible, the words that most beautifully express this renewal promised in Scripture are contained in the chapters right after the final battle in The Return of the King, which is the last book of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. One of my favorite parts is when, after the ring is destroyed at Mount Doom, Sam wakes up from his sleep, surprised he's alive, and surprised to see Gandalf. And then he says this, "Is everything sad going to come untrue?" What a question. And isn't that the question that every single one of us is asking? When we open our Bibles, the answer that we are given over and over and over is yes. Yes, everything sad is going to come untrue. We'll take a look at verse 8. "But cowards, faithless, detestable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their share will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death." We have a parallel to this in verse 27, which says, "Nothing unclean will ever enter it. nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, but only those written in the Lamb's Book of Life. So another thing that will be absent in the new creation are people whose hearts are bent toward idols, who refuse to live under the rule and reign of King Jesus. Now, if this were a study on hell, we would talk more about that. I do have plans to do a whole series on hell in the fall, so stay tuned for that. We'll take a closer look at these references to judgment then. I'm planning to call the series, What the Hell? Isn't that a great title? We'll skip down to verse 22. Let's give it a read. It says, I did not see a temple in it, because the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb are its temple. So there's another thing that isn't going to be in the new heaven, in the new earth. Now, we've already traced the temple theme, so I'm not going to spend much time here other than to say the picture John paints for us is of the entire new creation being the temple of God, just like the garden was back in Genesis 1 and 2. Now, one of my favorite details in the passage is in verse 16, where it says, the city is laid out in a square. Its length and width are the same. He measured the city with the rod at 12,000 stadia. Its length, width, and height are equal. So what's being described here is a cube. The one other cubic structure in the Bible is the Holy of Holies in Solomon's temple. You could read about that, 1 Kings 6, 19 through 20. Now, there is absolutely no way this is just a coincidence. Given the intense temple imagery here and the emphasis on God's unmediated presence throughout, the implication seems to be that the entire vision is of one giant, universe-wide Holy of Holies, which I think is pretty dang amazing. Look at verse 23. The city does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it because the glory of God illuminates it and its lamp is the Lamb. And then skip down to chapter 22, verse 5. Night will be no more. People will not need the light of the lamp or the light of the sun because the Lord God will give them light. All right, so another thing, apparently, is that there's no darkness, no night in the new heaven and the new earth. Now, just like with the sea, the point here is not that there will be no literal sun or moon or darkness or night. The point is that the brilliance of God's glory will be so far beyond anything we've ever experienced that we'll no longer think of any other light sources as necessary. They will pale in comparison. And that phrase, the night will be no more, is not a statement about literal night, but about what darkness represents. Remember, when we went back to the first couple verses of the Bible and the pre-creation state, not only was there chaos waters, but there was darkness. There was darkness. So darkness is also a symbol of decreation. We don't know much of true darkness in our modern suburban environments. Even nighttime isn't really dark, dark. But the darkness of night without modern electricity is a powerful symbol of fear and evil. That's the symbol. That's the image that John is playing with here. Here's the point of no sun, moon, or night. And I'm quoting here from G.K. Beale's quote unquote shorter, only 500 pages instead of, I don't know, 2,000 pages. On the book of Revelation, he says this, nothing from the old world will be able to hinder God's glorious presence from completely filling the new cosmos or the saints from unceasing access to that divine presence. That's the point. Last thing that won't be in the new creation, chapter 22, verse 3, very important, and there will no longer be any curse. The consequences of humanity's rebellion against God laid out in Genesis 3, the rupture of the relationship between humans and God, between humans and creation, between humans and each other, and all of the horrendous side effects of that rupture will be fully healed and fully restored, which is a mind-blowing concept. All right, so we've covered what will be missing in the new heaven and the new earth. Let's take a look at what will be present in the final heaven. The primary emphasis of the whole passage is that God's presence will be present among his people in a way that it never has been before. That's why there's no need for a temple or a light source. Take a look at chapter 22, verse 4. They will see his face and his name will be on their foreheads. This is a big deal, you guys, especially when you consider that in the old covenant, such a revelation of God's face would have brought death. Like this is a remarkable statement. Now, what's the deal with the name on the forehead? Well, in Exodus 28, 36 through 38, God's name was placed on the high priest's forehead. Holy to the Lord is specifically what was written. The high priest was the only one allowed access to the Holy of Holies, and even he could only go in once a year. But in the age to come, the privilege and original human vocation of being consecrated in order to be acceptable in the immediate presence of God is granted to all of his people. Now, as spirit-indwelt believers, we have a very significant foretaste of this right now. The New Testament clearly affirms that we already enjoy unmediated access to the Father through the work of Jesus. But there are aspects of that access that are not yet a reality for us. The biggest evidence of this is how stinking hard prayer can be. There's just so many barriers, many of our own making, to fully enjoying our access to the throne room of heaven. We cannot fully conceive of the intimacy and communion, the deep abiding fellowship we will enjoy with Father, Son, and Spirit in the age to come. Which is why marriage shows up so often in the Bible as the metaphor for the relationship between God and his people. The Bible starts with a marriage and the Bible ends with a marriage. The marriage it ends with is the one between Christ and the church. This, of course, begs the question, like, if this is our destiny, how should we be preparing ourselves for it? You know, how are we today cultivating our desire for him, readying ourselves to one day see his face? Well, another thing that will be present in the fully consummated kingdom of God is perfect safety and security. That's what all the measuring in these chapters is about. I'm quoting from G.K. Beale's commentary again. He says, the measurements of the city wall, based on Ezekiel 40 through 48, emphasize the security of the city. That is, the security of God's glorified covenant community in the eternal new creation. Nothing can harm them anymore, nor can any evil threaten them. End quote. Now, we need to keep in mind that the book of Revelation was originally written to a church under persecution. So the whole thing is an encouragement to resist temptations to compromise, an encouragement to persevere even through great hardship. What a relief for a suffering church to know that heaven is a place of perfect safety and security. No more pain, no more persecution, just complete and total safety in the presence of God. And the last thing we see in the passage that will be present in the new creation is a multi-ethnic worshiping community. Look at verse 3 of chapter 21. Then I heard a loud voice from the throne. Look, God's dwelling is with humanity, and he will live with them. They will be his peoples, and God himself will be with them and will be their God. Now, I put an emphasis on certain words when I read that for a reason. It is so significant in light of the storyline of Scripture that the word used here is humanity, peoples. All the nations throughout the whole world are included in those words. Now take a look at what's written in verses 24 through 26. The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. Its gates will never close by day, because it will never be night there. They will bring the glory and honor of the nations into it. I'm going to quote Beal again here. The reason that verses 24 through 26 refer to the nations bringing glory and honor into the city is to highlight the fact that they are bringing not literal riches, but themselves as worshipers before God's end times presence. The point of the figurative picture is that the believing Gentiles will never be separated from open, eternal access to God's presence, and that nothing evil can threaten such access. Now, I'm pretty sure none of us woke up this morning concerned about Gentile inclusion and the redeemed people of God. It's just something we assume. But it's a really big deal in the Bible, and it finds its ultimate fulfillment here in this description of the new creation. John's readers needed to hear afresh that Jews don't have special access to heaven. Neither do white Protestants. That's what readers of the Bible in our day, in our context, need to hear. God is building a multi-ethnic worshiping community. That is the whole reason he made a covenant with Abraham and his descendants in the first place. It was always, always, always with an eye to redeeming the whole world. All right, so that completes our list of things that will be present in the new creation. We're almost done. I want to close things out by taking a look at the fulfillment that we see in this passage. Look with me at chapter 21, verse 6. Then he said to me, "It is done." Skipping down to chapter 22, verse 1. Then he showed me the river of the water of life, clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the city's main street. The tree of life was on each side of the river, bearing 12 kinds of fruit, producing its fruit each month. The leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations, and there will no longer be any curse. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in the city, and his servants will worship him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. Night will be no more. People will not need the light of the lamp or the light of the sun, because the Lord God will give them light, and they will reign forever and ever. Do you see all of the Eden references there? And that phrase in verse 6 is so important. It is done. What is done? God's plan A is done. The cosmic renewal of all things is done. The glory of Yahweh filling the earth as the waters fill the sea is done. God being all in all is done. The resurrection is done. Now, I've got God's plan A written on the listening guide for you. Let's go through it and check off what's fulfilled in the new creation based on Revelation 21 and 22. An earthly kingdom. Check. We see that in 21, 1 through 3. Ruled by human imagers. Check. 22, verse 5. In a cosmic temple. Check. Pretty much every verse of this passage is about that. Where God dwells with humans. Check. That's explicitly stated in 21:3. Who act as priests. Check. 22:4. In a special heaven and earth space. Check. 21:1 and 12. Which God expands throughout the whole world. Check. The whole passage points to this. You guys, this right here is the Bible's epic full circle moment. Every promise ever made is perfectly fulfilled by the one who is faithful and true. About a year ago, I went to the eye doctor and I got a pair of eyeglasses. And I got a pair of eyeglasses because I can barely see out of my left eye. Now, my right eye is a total rock star, but it really shouldn't have to do all the work. That is not fair. I really like my glasses. I think they're cute. They definitely help me see better, particularly out of that left eye. But there's one problem with these glasses. They make me nauseous when I wear them. I start to feel sick after a few minutes. Now, I called the eye doctor and he said that was very normal, especially for people who have one really good eye that has been compensating for a really bad eye for years and years and years. He said to wear them for a small amount of time every day and to progressively increase that amount of time. He said, if I'm consistent with that, my body will adjust and I won't feel sick anymore. The way to stop feeling like garbage when I wear them is to keep wearing them. So I have tried many times. After about 15 or 20 minutes of that nauseous feeling, I take them off, stick them in the case, and tell myself I'll try again tomorrow. I've been doing this for an entire year. Yes, it is time for me to make another appointment. My point is that for me, the path to seeing more clearly has been really uncomfortable, painful even. The exact same thing can be said of studying the Bible. We all grow up seeing certain things a certain way, drawing certain conclusions. We're all deeply shaped by our particular Christian subculture. Sometimes our study of the Bible reveals that we've been wrong, which by default means facing the fact that some of our most beloved preachers and teachers have been wrong. And then we start to think, what else have I been wrong about? Those discoveries can feel disorienting and icky. And sometimes I just want to take off the new set of lenses and stuff them in the drawer because it's a heck of a lot easier to stay ignorant and maintain status quo than it is to actually learn new things. And I know for some of you listening, this series has confronted many long-held assumptions about heaven. And that's hard. That's uncomfortable. That feels bad. I know that because I went through the same thing. And I want you to know that it means so much to me that you have been willing to wear the new set of lenses, even when it felt uncomfortable and disorienting. And maybe you've decided they're not the right lenses for you. Maybe I haven't convinced you of my conclusions. If all I've done in this series is shake your thoughts on heaven up a little bit and facilitated some critical thinking, I am totally satisfied with that. And I am incredibly proud of you for making it through all of these episodes, for thinking through all of these things. We have really plunged some depths here. And so anyway, I just want to say I'm super proud of you. In the spirit of shaking things up, I will be recording one more episode in this series. And that episode is going to be focused on the rapture. When I taught this material to the women at my church, there were a lot of questions about how the rapture fits into the heaven is here thesis of this series. So I want to talk about that. Come on back for one more episode. After that, we'll take a little break. And then I've got a really fabulous summer book club planned for June and July. I think you are really going to love it. I'm super pumped about it. Can't wait to tell you more about it. All right. Well, that's it for today. I'll meet you back here next week for some rapture talk. Bye, friends. Her God Speaks is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that is supported in part by listeners like you. If you'd like to support this ministry, you can make a donation by visiting hergodspeaks.com and clicking the donation tab on the drop-down menu, or by tapping the donate link in the show notes. Thank you so much for helping us help women hear, know, and glorify God through compassionate, Christ-centered engagement with the Bible theology.